You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. Let's get right to it. We're here today to talk about NATO, what it means to Putin, what it meant when the wall came down so many years ago. Is it what we think, or is it considerably more complex? History tells us a lot. And so today we're speaking with Simon Miles. He is the author of Engaging with the Evil Empire, Washington, Moscow, and the Beginning of the End of the Cold War. Simon is also an assistant professor of Slavic and Eurasian studies at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. Have I hit it right?
Yes.
Great. Hey, Simon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get right to it. NATO had the Warsaw Pact. How did these two alliances develop in the first place? Teach us a little history here.
Yeah, the proverbial sharks and the jets of the Cold War. So the origins of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the Warsaw Pact both are rooted in kind of the uncertainty of what was going to happen at the end of World War II. It came to be that Europe started to look quite divided as Joseph Stalin, the leader of the Soviet Union, insisted on basically a sphere of influence in Eastern Europe, which rapidly became a sphere of domination in Eastern Europe. Meanwhile, in Western Europe, countries like Britain, France, the Benelux countries, all tried to rebuild in the aftermath of the devastations of the Second World War. So let's talk about NATO first. In order to understand NATO, we need to understand another American policy initiative, which actually stemmed from Washington, and that's the Marshall Plan. So it's probably no surprise to your listeners that World War II extracted a horrible toll on the nations of Western Europe and, of course, Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. Bombing, strategic bombing, pitched battles in urban centers in many cases, left a whole lot that needed to be rebuilt. And so the Marshall Plan was the Truman administration, President Harry Truman's, effort to help kickstart European reconstruction, named after the Secretary of State, George C. Marshall, at the time. The Marshall Plan was a lot of money, but the Marshall Plan didn't address one key question, which was what we would probably today call investor confidence. If you had built a brand new factory in 1919 after World War I, your return on investment was, odds are, not great, because about two decades later, it was flattened again. The point of NATO was to show to the Europeans, not only are we going to help reconstruct you, but we're going to stand by you. And by standing by you, we are going to diminish the likelihood of yet another cataclysmic total war on the European continent. So NATO is actually a European initiative to which the United States acquiesces. And I think that's the first really important point that we need to acknowledge here, is that NATO is built up by the Europeans. It's not imposed by the Americans. Fast forward now about a half a decade to the mid-1950s, NATO is really coming into its own. In the wake, for example, of the Korean War, which really escalated the perception of threat, countries started to ask what were at the time really politically difficult questions. Like, for example, what do we do about Germany? In the immediate aftermath of World War II, the decision is made to partition the country. But then the two halves of Germany, which we'll just call West and East Germany, are administered in very different ways. The Kremlin sees its role in Germany as, above all, extraction, that is to say, extracting reparations for the Second World War, and, of course, imposes a communist regime under the leadership of a man named Walter Ulbricht. The Americans, the British, and the French initially also start thinking along, let's say, punitive lines. But over the years, they realize that the logic behind punishing Germany was that a powerful Germany would be too powerful really to contain, and had twice in very recent memory started cataclysmic wars. Then the calculus starts to shift when the world starts to look a lot more dangerous. When Joseph Stalin isn't just hard to deal with, he's a threat. And then the conversation starts to be, we should rearm Germany, which is politically huge. If you tell the people of France, or frankly, the people of Poland, that Germany is going to be rearmed, this doesn't sound like good news. This doesn't sound like a recipe for safety. In response to that, the Eastern European states with the Soviet Union form what comes to be called the Warsaw Pact as a sort of retaliation for the policy of rearming and integrating into NATO of West Germany.
Okay, well, that's considerably more nuanced than you will see in the U.S. press. And I'd query which you see as the sharks and which you see as the jets in this situation. Because remember, when you're a jet all the way from your Tourette to your last dying day.
Well, I think that means the NATO are the jets, right? Because they stay. And the Warsaw Pact members, after the Warsaw Pact collapses in 1991, all want to join NATO. But I think we're going to talk more about that a little later.
Let's go to the time when things start to change and they shift dramatically, which is the fall of the Berlin Wall, which was heralded in the United States and I think in a lot of countries as a real triumphant moment for democratic values. But let's be realistic here. What was the impact on former Warsaw Pact countries? And frankly, what was the impact on what happened subsequently in Russia in terms of their perception of these alliances and NATO in particular?
Well, first and foremost, the story of kind of Eastern Europe's integration with the West begins a decade plus before the actual Berlin Wall falls down. In actual fact, the Berlin Wall was much more porous in terms of governments and policies than is often acknowledged. It certainly was a very rigid barrier for people, and to the best extent that the Eastern Bloc could make it so, a rigid barrier for ideas. You know, Radio Free Europe was jammed and things like that, not always successfully, of course. So by the time the late 1980s are coming around, in fact, it's a pretty common understanding in Eastern European capitals that change is coming. They don't know it's going to be as sharp and as revolutionary as when the Berlin Wall falls on the night of the 9th of November, 1989. But governments in places like, for example, Hungary are starting to open up the borders with neighboring Austria. Hungary also is starting to allow more and more market activity in its economy. Countries like Poland are opening up the political system and allowing non-communists, in this case, the Solidarity Trade Union, to participate in what at the time are called round tables, but we would think of as kind of basically participating in government. And then the Berlin Wall comes down. So it's not necessarily just this black and white kind of transformation, though it is, of course, revolutionary. When the wall comes down, and most importantly, when the Soviet Union does nothing about that, doesn't try to stop it, doesn't try to do what they did in Czechoslovakia in 1968, doesn't try to do what they had done in Hungary in 1956, then even communist politicians recognize that the time has come to try to cast their lot in with the West. So viewed from as diverse a range of places as East Berlin to Bucharest, Romania, the sense of the time, this is the very late 1980s, very early 1990s, is that the future belongs to, let's say, Western-style institutions. Now, we always talk about this in the context of NATO, right? NATO expansion, all that. They're not talking about NATO in Eastern Europe in 1989, 1990, and 1991. They're talking about, at the time, the European Economic Community, what we now know as the European Union, because they see the key to their own success and prosperity in the future as European political, social, and cultural, and of course, above all, economic integration. By participating in the free trade and sort of commonwealth of Europe. So why NATO? Well, they're actually basically told NATO is your stepping stone. Let's not forget that in the early 1990s, the European Union is still a fledgling entity, right? 1993's Maastricht Treaty hasn't yet gone into effect. And so Eastern Bloc politicians are kind of going to Brussels and saying, hey, we'd really love to join the EU. The EU folks are saying, well, you know, we kind of are just getting this thing off the ground. And frankly, negotiating the Maastricht Treaty was a nightmare. The last thing we want to do is reopen that in order to add more people. So why don't you just go kind of down the road to NATO, sign on there, and then we will take, you know, further steps in the future once you've kind of proven your bona fides.
So NATO was the country club where you could meet the people who would help you start the business.
And EU was the big deal, which isn't to say that they weren't happy for NATO membership or interested in an American kind of Article 5 security guarantee. But the North Star that's sort of driving policy in Eastern European countries at this time, even amongst avowedly communist leaders, is the European Union.
Yeah, well, without trade, they weren't doing so well financially, and that makes perfect sense.
And they needed access to technology. That was another big part of it, is their economies were backwards and grossly inefficient. They needed access on a large, large scale to Western technology, as opposed to kind of one-off licensing deals and joint ventures, which they'd been doing in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm. And Russia wasn't particularly known for their technology and wasn't able to supply that. Although I will say, I see a lot of those old Ladas driving around Africa and they seem to be just fine. Okay, well, let's go to the 1990s. I don't know that a lot of the young lawyers, a lot of the sort of young policymakers really realize what happened in the 1990s in terms of NATO expansion. Can you talk about how NATO expanded during the 90s? Who exactly or what administration was driving that expansion? And what did that do to the psyche of people who had lived for 40 years under the pact or sort of under the general understanding, the social contract that really was created in Moscow?
Well, I think the story of NATO expansion is often told as kind of the story of Bill Clinton's hubris. You know, if the shoe fits, right? But I think the driving force behind NATO expansion is actually governments in Hungary.
I'm sorry to correct you. Some would say his charm. He did have, he had a tendency. People liked him because the world disappears when you talk to him, apparently.
He is one of the great retail politicians. The drivers of a lot of NATO expansion are not to be found in the United States, right? It's actually the governments in Budapest, Hungary, Prague in the newly sort of separated Czech Republic, and right here where I'm speaking to you from in Warsaw, Poland, that were the first three to join and were passionate advocates for themselves. Why? Again, because they saw this as part of integrating into a much broader European political and cultural space. So take someone like Václav Havel, who's the president of the Czech Republic. He really chafed at the idea that Prague was sort of some eastern backwater. He would frequently point out, for example, that it is geographically further west than, for example, Vienna, Austria, which happens to be true. And that Prague had been in his sort of social milieu, Havel was a playwright, had been sort of cut off from their rightful European patrimony. And so in the United States, of course, it's critical that the Clinton administration is, to an even greater extent than the H.W. Bush administration before it, is very receptive to these overtures. But a lot of the push is coming from Eastern European states who want NATO membership because they want the opportunities of Europe. Meanwhile, though, I know I said that in the very late 80s, the story was really about these economic opportunities. Meanwhile, let's look at the Russian Federation, right? And there are basically two key factors, I think, that we need to think about here. The first is that it is political chaos, right? Both 1991 features a coup, 1993 features a sort of tanks in the streets, feels very much like onset of some kind of civil war. Politically, if you are even remotely in Russia's neighborhood, this needs to be grounds for concern, because what is going on in the Kremlin is deeply disquieting to European, Eastern European leaders who are envisioning a future away from Russia. The second critical element of this is that Russia is at this point fighting a brutal war in Chechnya, in the Northern Caucasus. So at the same time as Russian President Boris Yeltsin is saying to the Eastern Europeans, you know, why can't you count on us for your security? We helped provide your security for the last, you know, four or so decades. These Eastern European leaders are looking at the Russian brutal war in Chechnya and worrying that the combination of political instability that could install someone much less friendly to their aspirations, plus this capacity for brutality, would potentially spell disaster for not just their European project, but for them.
Let me ask you a question there. I think the other thing they were witnessing, and I welcome correction here, is they were witnessing the absorption of assets, rightfully those of the Russian people, by these various oligarchs and a corrupt system that had been corrupt, I'm sure, during the communist era, but was increasingly obviously corrupted through this process, some of which, you know, then relatively young Vladimir Putin, given his sort of various political roles at the time, was becoming more involved in.
Sure. No one would look at what was going on in Russia in the 1990s and say, you know what, that's the horse I want to hitch my wagon to, right? In terms of the onset of the massive kleptocracy, the large-scale war crimes in Chechnya, political instability, economic collapse. They have two basically catastrophic financial crises in one decade, 1992 and in 1998. Whereas if you looked at Western Europe and if you looked at unified Germany, that looked like a model. Certainly the way East Germany was integrated into West Germany was imperfect, but the way East Germany was integrated into West Germany was a wholesale takeover by West German institutions that did a lot, again, not everything right, to rapidly increase standard of living in that region.
Yeah, except decommissioning nuclear and then growing dependent on Russia's LNG, probably ill-considered in retrospect.
Yeah, that's a later policy that was really pushed by the Greens in much more recent years, which, yes, was completely misguided.
Completely misguided. But, you know, we've had these situations in history where people such as yourself, big thinkers on these topics, suddenly get access to a trove of documents. There were the Venona papers. You know, there are all these things that people can get access to who are researchers, but you've gotten access to the Warsaw Pact archives. So a couple questions on that. How did that happen? And what are you finding?
So the how it happened is not a story about me, and it's not a story about my kind of doggedness or ingenuity. In the 1990s, basically all of these countries passed various types of legislation mandating transparency on the history from the communist period. Oftentimes, the target in the earliest phases of this were the secret police. So in East Germany, it was the Stasi, the Ministry for State Security. In Poland, it was the SB. In Czechoslovakia, it was the STB, the Staatne Bezpieczeństwo, the secret police, whose archives were legally mandated to be opened up because there was a sense among people that their basic rights of privacy had been wholesale violated by the state, and they were not wrong. East Germany, you know, had the most sort of comprehensive system of informants and surveillance that human society has ever cooked up. So those laws are really a gift for historians like me, because they enshrine a right to access to what were formerly amongst the most closely guarded secrets. In the early years, a lot of people use this to find out, you know, their personal histories, sometimes very tragically discovering that loved ones were informing on them in exchange for, you know, small favors from the secret police. Here I'm talking about, you know, children informing on parents, husbands informing on wives, and vice versa.
Gosh, that's like 1984. That's pretty sickening.
Oh, it's utterly Orwellian. The most bizarre that I ever came across personally in the Stasi archives was a kindergarten teacher informing on a child in her class, which of course then triggered investigations into the child's parents and his entire kind of community, because he said something pejorative about Leonid Brezhnev in 1982 when Brezhnev died. He said something like, "At last the pig is dead." So this is now an extraordinary resource for someone like me, who wants to get into the official mind of these formerly very, very closed off states. And while I'm very interested in, you know, foreign intelligence and things like that, I'm not so much looking at those domestic repression questions right now in my work. But what I am finding is an absolute treasure trove of documents about war plans, including nuclear war, bargaining and haggling and negotiating between the ostensibly all-powerful Soviet Union and its much smaller, much weaker partners, like, for example, Romania, which under Nicolae Ceausescu, who was the dictator of Romania from the mid-1960s until he was executed in 1989, he was a brutal and also deeply weird dictator.
Deeply weird. You got to put some gloss on that here, Simon.
So Ceausescu admired, I think it's fair to say, the aesthetic of the North Korean regime, even if he didn't want to go as far. So I remember very fondly on a trip to Bucharest about, I guess it was about 2 years ago now, a tour of his palace, which included not just golden toilets, as is the, you know, all apparently the rage in the highest corridors of power in the United States, but entire golden bathrooms. And some of the most elaborate but gaudy mosaic work. His wife was elevated to the status of kind of basically smartest woman in Romania, despite not being probably the smartest woman in Romania. His son, Nico, was a drunk and almost certainly a serial rapist, and was allowed to kind of just maraud around Bucharest. It was a really horrific regime, but Ceausescu kind of imbued it with this very bizarre aesthetic sensibility.
And it ended kind of unceremoniously for Ceausescu. There was a moment where he came out to address the public and it was over.
Right. So one of Ceausescu's favorite things was giving speeches to enormous crowds of adoring fans. Entire factories would be detailed to send their workforce to watch and applaud and cry and do the appropriate thing at the
appropriate
time. The
whole dear leader shtick, right?
Yeah, exactly. This like very bizarre kind of Kim Dynasty style performance ritual. And eventually in 1989, Ceausescu staged one of these, I guess we could say. The people didn't play along. Now, at this point, there were already rumblings of trouble mostly in kind of the Transylvanian part of Romania. But in this time, you know, Ceausescu expected to be greeted by an audience of devoted admirers. And I think he did actually believe that these people all loved him. I think he was quite deluded in that sense, even though he certainly knew that he needed an extensive secret police apparatus to stop the people who loved him so much from killing him. The people didn't play their part. And he is booed and shouted at. And it rapidly dawns on him as the crowd becomes a mob that his time in office has come to an end. So he and his wife actually sort of helicopter out into the countryside to try to escape, try to hide for a while. They're found. He and his wife, Elena, are basically put on trial in some tiny rural schoolhouse. They are very expeditiously, i.e. in a matter of minutes, found guilty of, you know, treason and unspeakable crimes against the Romanian people, sentenced to death. And in a matter of just a few more minutes, they're basically just taken out back and shot. Romania is the only revolution of 1989 that turns really violent like that. And that is because of the uniquely kind of, for lack of a better term, depraved way in which Ceausescu ran his country with violence. He teed it up in a pretty profound way. He's the only leader who is killed. Many others will go to prison, for example, but Ceausescu is the only one who's killed.
But in, you know, lurking in the background of all of this was Vladimir Putin, who had been with what was then the KGB, ultimately became the FSB. He was a professional. He took his job, I think, pretty seriously. Obviously had some sort of complex. But in looking at this archive material, it has to inform your view of what is happening right now with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And I wonder how it has.
Well, so let's take one example, and that's actually from Vladimir Putin's life. Vladimir Putin had a front row seat to the collapse of communism in East Germany. He is, you know, posted to Dresden, which is the third most important city in East Germany at the time. And he works out of a KGB facility that is kind of contained within a bigger Stasi East German secret police facility. And one night on the 9th of December, that facility was broken into actually by East Germans who wanted to see their files. They wanted to see the copious records that the state was keeping on them. They will succeed in getting into the Stasi repository there, even though as they do that, you know, Stasi officers are racing to burn or shred as much of the documentation that they've generated as possible before it's found. Eventually, the crowd turns on Putin, who is not alone, but I think is only sort of with a few clerical staff at this little sort of Russian sub-compound. And they start trying to break down those gates as well. And Putin tries to call for help, but he is basically told, "You're on your own, kid. You know, no help is coming." And this is still at a time when the Soviet Union has about 400,000 troops in East Germany. You know, it's not like they would have had to have put people on planes from Moscow to help out, right? They were just virtually, literally down the road. They had tank divisions. So Putin's told, "You're on your own, buddy." And as his people are basically trying to burn as much of their stuff as possible, he effectively kind of bluffs the crowd, sort of threatening that if they don't dissipate, they'll be shot by all the Russians with guns there. There are none. But I think this really has a profound impact on Putin in two ways. First, he writes about this. He says that he learned at that time that the Soviet Union had a terminal illness, and that was a paralysis of power. And I think in his governance of Russia, this is central to how he thinks, that Russian power is always something that you need to be ready to use, that you don't sort of just hold it in reserve, but rather that you use it to show that you have it and to show that you're willing to use it. And that it's only that that generates kind of the international respect and sort of heft that Russia deserves, that you have to demonstrate power in order to be given credit for having the power, basically. And the second thing I think that it learns is, look, he is living at this point in the late 1980s in the world's most sophisticated autocracy in terms of control and penetration of everyday life. No one, certainly not Hitler's Germany, not the Soviet Union, has ever come close to that level of sort of deep, sophisticated, autocratic control. And yet even that was brought down. And so I think that makes Putin keenly aware today of his own position. I think it's certainly no exaggeration to say that he does not think that there is a retirement for him, that the end of his presidency
been the history, has it?
Yeah, the end of his presidency is the end of his life, and he would rather not have that accelerated, but he knows just how close run a thing that could be.
don't know that he really grasps how much he's setting that on course himself through his behavior right now. I do understand he has sort of this binary view of things. Let's flash forward. We find ourselves having to deal with him again, having to sort of consider the history of NATO, what it means to him. I'd like to talk to you about recent comments and discourse in the United States on NATO. So if I can just set the stage again, subject to your correction, many Democrats believe that we need a larger flow of economic support to Ukraine, as well as, you know, whatever we can provide in terms of weapons. Now, there is another view on the Republican side, and I don't mean to give it any longer attention, but the reason I'm focusing on our giving details is I think they're worth discussing. First, you had originally, as you may remember, Donald Trump complaining that NATO members were not paying a certain amount. Now, originally, you know, there was a lot of pushback, like it's not a purse that everybody's putting money into, but it's something else, right? It's what percentage of their GDP.
So 2% of GDP on defense spending has sort of become this threshold.
Okay. So not everybody was doing that, who was a member of NATO who aspired for membership in NATO, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's very true. There are a lot of countries, you know, Canada, for example, they're sitting more at like 1.5%.
But I would note a couple things. Recently, the Danish Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, has called for her country to start upping its spending on defense. I am hearing, we've heard of other European leaders saying this. Now, I'll tell you why I think this has come into sort of full relief of late. There is a congressman out there. His name is J.D. Vance. I'm not particularly a fan of him, but he has shown up at the Munich Security Conference. And I think in a sort of poking Europeans in the eyes kind of way, has written an op-ed piece in the Financial Times, which is widely read by European leaders. And it's entitled, Europe Must Stand on Its Own Two Feet on Defense. And I wondered, let's just kind of walk through some of the things that he said. He argues first that NATO members are creating a tax on American citizens in two ways. First, by not paying the amount of money that they should, or not spending the amount of money that they should on defense. But he makes a second point, and he said the NATO member nations have let their stockpiles of materiel disappear and are leaning on the United States to drain its critical stockpiles of materiel. Now, he adds in this that wars are won, rather, with men and materiel. And on this point, I think he's going to get some traction. He points out that the average age of a Ukrainian soldier is now 43, and that it really is only a matter of time before other countries will have to answer the call in support of Ukraine. And he says everything NATO members in Europe are doing right now suggests that they think that the United States will provide all three, men, money, and materiel. So I just wonder what you make of this argument and how this is being received in places like where you are right now, like Poland.
Well, I think we need to start, before we get into the senator from Ohio's comments, by acknowledging that the United States has always been very ambivalent about Europe standing on its own in terms of defense. And there have been many episodes throughout American foreign policy history in which Europe has started to look like it's going to stand on its own. And American leaders have said, wait, wait, pump the brakes. Maybe it would be a little bit better if you did less and let us take care of that. And there are various reasons why that has been American policy, including, you know, simply worrying that too powerful a European bloc wouldn't need America. And as such, the United States would be cast out, not, you know, literally unceremoniously, but would not have a place in Europe. So when Vance is saying, you know, you're doing these things, you need to stop it, a lot of what those European countries are doing has been what their American counterparts have wanted them to do, which is don't go too far in terms of military development. It is certainly the case, though, that Europe has real problems right now. It is not uniquely a European problem. It's also a problem in the United States that what we call the defense industrial base is hollowed out, that the assembly lines that produce a lot of the weapons of war that are being used right now in Ukraine, or their kind of analogs, are shut down. In many cases, they've been converted to make civilian products. And it is, you can't just start these things up like a light switch. That's a problem.
It's not like the movies, you know, where they turn the machine on and everybody floods back in and it just happens.
It's not.
Right?
It's not. We saw, for example, in the United States, right, the extraordinary performance of the Javelin anti-tank missile in the early months of the Ukraine war then gave way to kind of an American national panic about not having enough Javelins. The same was true also of Stinger, sort of man-portable anti-air missiles as well. And so this is a serious problem in Europe. It's a serious problem in the United States as well. And so when Vance says that this is a problem in Europe, he's not wrong. I agree with him on that point. It's also a problem in the United States. The issue, I think, becomes that it's not clear how abandoning the Europeans helps solve that problem.
Or whether it forestalls an inevitable thing that Putin won't stop. You know, as you've described his love affair with this image of Russian strength, is it we do something now, or are we going to end up having to do something much more later to push back on him?
We started talking about the Marshall Plan earlier, right? And the basic logic of the Marshall Plan is that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. It's always better to deal with problems in their infancy and when they are further away. And I think what history has shown us is that not doing so doesn't mean that those problems just get bigger but stay over there. And I think that what Vance, what former President Trump and other people in that kind of, let's call them neo-isolationist camp, don't understand is that Vladimir Putin is a problem that is not just going to stay over there. That Ukraine is not sort of the sum total of his ambitions. And we've seen that include, you know, look at what the Russians have been doing just in recent months. Huge levels of infiltration in the Baltic states and in the Scandinavian, the Nordic state countries as well. That's being openly reported on by those countries' intelligence services.
And let's talk a little bit about what that looks like. Can you give some more specifics here? Because I don't know that everyone listening to this cast would know this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So in countries like, for example, you know, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, there's a sizable ethnic Russian and Russian-speaking minority in those countries. The Kremlin has tried to co-opt with, frankly, not enormous degrees of success, because most of those people recognize that their lives are better in like Lithuania, an EU and NATO member state, than their lives would be if they were living back in Mother Russia, where things are not going so great right now. And so a lot of these efforts have to do with trying to foment opposition. The Kremlin is really finding, let's call them sort of blood and soil, conservative, kind of far right political parties to be a very useful tool of its influence. We've seen that also, you know, in the United States with efforts to discredit the Biden administration, President Biden himself, through, you know, his son Hunter Biden's activities. And while I give full credence to the theory that Hunter Biden is not a great guy, that seems pretty clear at this point. The efforts by known Russian intelligence assets to get the Republican Party to kind of pursue criminal and impeachment type prosecutions against the Biden White House are, you know, serving the Kremlin's objectives. So what we see, I think, is a willingness by the Kremlin to explore the realm of the possible. Recently, for example, this manifested itself in France with, according to reporting, Russian intelligence operatives trying to incite anti-Semitic hate crimes by spray painting Stars of David on the homes and businesses of Jews in France. This is not necessarily, you know, the prelude to a Kremlin ground invasion of France, but the problem in Ukraine is the most calamitous, but it's certainly not circumscribed.
And let me add, and I'm sure you're aware of it, for those listeners who don't know, there is currently a sort of pro-Kremlin propaganda movie that is currently being shown all across Italy in cinemas. And is billed as entertainment, and the cinemas are packed. I mean, Italians in small places are going to look at this stuff. He's trying a variety of fronts. And I think it's very naive to imagine that this isn't going to increase in the coming years, months.
And he's shown a willingness to do it in the United States, right? Look at the 2016 election. Look at the use of Kremlin cutouts to disseminate illegally disclosed information from within, you know, the U.S. military, the U.S. intelligence community. I wonder where this confidence comes from, that this is a problem that is just going to stay an ocean away, because I see no evidence to that effect. In fact, I see an acute willingness to bring this, you know, to visit this on the United States and its other partners and allies on the part of the Kremlin. And that's why supporting Ukraine is, I think, so absolutely critical for American national security.
Let's bring this up to date. Horrifyingly, this is moving forward in ways that I don't think even yesterday, I think we would have anticipated. But for our listeners, as of this recording, French President Emmanuel Macron has suggested sending Western ground troops into Ukraine. This was shot down by Germany's deputy chancellor, Robert Habeck. He fired back that what Ukraine needed was weapons. And let me tell you how Putin responded to that. He did. He responded publicly. And he said that he had weapons that could go inside France and do significant harm, and that he was prepared to use them. And so that is something to know. Are you hearing that over there as well?
In this neighborhood, Kremlin saber rattling is not new. Of course, you know, the Kremlin has a very sizable nuclear arsenal, which if you add up all of their deployed, stockpiled, and slated for destruction but not yet destroyed warheads is about 6,000, just shy of 6,000 nuclear warheads. These are civilization extinguishing nuclear capabilities. What I think is really important is that, one, what Macron was talking about was moving Western troops into Western Ukraine in order to free up the Ukrainian military to do, you know, the frontline combat in the Eastern Ukraine southeastern Ukraine, where the actual sort of flood is, where the actual contact with the enemy is. What Macron was not suggesting was that, you know, the French Foreign Legion was going to take over, you know, was going to go try to retake Avdiivka or Bakhmut or something like that. Of course, this was not well received. It was a bizarre idea. I don't really know why he said this publicly, if I'm being honest. Well, I certainly think that there is a lot more that the West can do, up to and including sending military advisors to the front lines. That sort of scale that Macron seems to be talking about was not something that I think anyone was going to go for. It's ironic that the German government, which is withholding weapons, withholding, for example, the Taurus cruise missile, which the Ukrainians could put to quite devastating effect, as we've seen them do with the analogous Storm Shadow cruise missile provided by the United Kingdom. It's ironic that that is the point that the German vice chancellor would make, because yes, the Ukrainians do need weapons. And the German government, as is the Biden administration, is, I think, unreasonably and unproductively withholding those.
Okay, well, we'll get on to this news segment in a moment, but I just want to tell our listeners that leaked documents have shown Russia rehearsed using tactical nuclear weapons early in the conflict in Ukraine. More on that in future podcasts, since apparently there were a lot of documents leaked. Simon, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. I would ask you, come back and see us in a while. It's been lovely to have you on, and we hope that you will come back to talk to us again, because things will develop. And this is an area of considerable expertise for you, and we really value the time that you've given us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks, we're moving on now. We're headed into news, national security news, some of which is making it to the front papers, some of it not so much. On the topic of the unitary executive, President Biden is issuing an executive order that would ban data brokers from selling Americans' data to foreign entities. We've only talked about that on the podcast. during 6 podcasts by my count. Congress did not pass a law that banned this. So again, unitary executive, it would be nice if they would talk to each other on the Hill. And apparently after Congress would not take steps, by the way, we will have to say more about this new EO in upcoming episodes. We hope to have somebody from NSC or the White House join us. We told you last week that McKinsey, the elite global consulting firm, was in Congress's crosshairs for its work for the Chinese government. Can McKinsey push back? Newspapers are reporting today that McKinsey's own website apparently touted its advice to the Chinese ministries, which would appear to contradict, obviously, the company's denial of service to the Chinese Communist Party. As this was unfolding, we learned from the Washington Post that documents from a Chinese state hacking group were leaked, showing a vast effort by China to hack into major foreign companies and infrastructure, including not just ours, but also those of other countries. But importantly, some of the hackers apparently bragged that they could target users of Microsoft, Apple, and Google. I'm sure none of our listeners use those services. Mandiant, which is a fabulous cybersecurity firm, is going through this trove of documents, and we will be hearing more about this in the future. On the topic of China, it is sending research vessels just 24 nautical miles off of Taiwan yet again lately. These vessels are typically used to check things like water temperature and to map seabed data, but they've also been sent dangerously close to Japan and the U.S. territory of Guam and have been accompanied, apparently, or at least so the reporting suggests, by aerial drones, or who knows, maybe those are subsea drones, suggesting that China is engaged in some sort of surveillance activity, menacing otherwise. And Russia, Russia, Russia. They've jailed yet another human rights activist, this one, Oleh Orlov, who was head of Memorial. Just in case you don't know, Memorial is a group that opposed the Russian war in Ukraine. Terrible thing to do. His crime appears to have been writing an anti-war article. All right, now back to Europe. Ursula von der Leyen, the EU commissioner, has suggested that Europe fund Ukraine's defense by using the seized assets of Russian oligarchs, who we learned were enriched when they seized basically the natural resources and any remaining infrastructure that rightfully belonged to the Russian people. The leaks just won't stop. And as we mentioned earlier, apparently leaked documents show that Russia rehearsed using tactical nuclear weapons. Okay, folks, thank you for listening. Share this podcast with a friend. When you do, have a conversation that involves listening to each other. Our strength is our unity and our ability to discuss hard things. We try to do that here in a tone of civility. We encourage you to do the same. Have comments for us. You can find us on social media platforms under the handle at ABA NatSec. You can always email us at natsec@americanbar.org. I just want to thank you for listening today. Your writer, producer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet, but I do this in my individual capacity always. Our editor is the lovely Francis Burkham of Brooklyn, and my co-producer. My other co-producer is the amazing Holly McMahon, who, by the way, can juggle plates and do 5 other things at the same time. She is something to behold. And the other producers of this podcast are always the members of the American Bar Association Standing Committee on Law and National Security. These towering figures and brilliant minds are the very reason for this podcast, and we thank them. Without them, it would not be possible. We'll see you next week.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.